Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the claim by Donald Trump, without any supporting evidence, that he would have won the popular vote but for the millions of fraudulent votes cast. Dan Wallach, a professor in the systems group at Rice University's Department of Computer Science, where he manages Rice's computer security lab and does research on the security of electronic voting machines, joins us to discuss the recount underway in Wisconsin that was initiated by the Green Party's Jill Stein, which Donald Trump has condemned. We will look into the reasons why a recount is needed, given the intelligence community's concerns about Russian interference in our elections, and that since a paper audit trail is available in Wisconsin and Michigan, a recount will provide a more accurate count and either confirm or dispel any outside interference in our recent close election. Then we will speak with Wayne White, a former expert with the Iraq Study Group, who was the Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Researcher's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. He joins us to discuss his article at Loblog, "Obama Brought the Islamic State to Its Knees, Watch Donald Trump Take the Credit," and assess how much longer the Islamic State will survive in Mosul and Raqqa, and the impact of the likely fall of Aleppo in terms of a flood of refugees into Turkey, where Erdogan, who was angry with the EU over his criticism of his purges, could unlock the doors to the camps and send refugees flooding into Europe. Then finally, we will speak with Anne-Louise Bardach, a Penn USA award-winning journalist and author who is an expert on Cuba, having written extensively about Fidel Castro in Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. She interviewed Castro at length for Vanity Fair, which she wrote about in The Guardian, Glory and My Place in History Do Not Worry Me, My Interview with Fidel Castro. And we will discuss her interview in which, when asked what would happen to Cuba after his death, Castro replied, "It's not my fault that I haven't died yet. It's not my fault that the CIA failed to kill me." And joining us now is Dan Wallach, who's a professor in the systems group at Rice University's Department of Computer Science, where he manages Rice's computer security lab. His research interests include mobile code, wireless and smartphone security, and the security of electronic voting systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Wallach.
Pleasure to be here with you.
And Dan, Donald Trump made the remark on Twitter that he would have won the popular vote, and Hillary Clinton's over 2 million ahead in the popular vote as the counting continues. He said he would have won the popular vote but for millions of fraudulent votes. He didn't provide any evidence for that claim. But there is a voting audit underway in the state of Wisconsin, which also Donald Trump has complained about. But my understanding is that that was prompted by the work of Alex Haldeman and John Boniface, a voting attorney specializing in voting rights. So what's your sense of this recount that's already become controversial that has been led by the Green Party candidate?
Okay. Well, for starters, I have no reason to believe Trump's tweet. There's no data that suggests anything about these millions of alleged fraudulent votes. That said, that we do know, you know, from our president and from the director of the NSA, that there were Russian state attempts to interfere with our election. The Russians appear to have been responsible for hacks of the DNC and other government official and Democratic Party email servers, and there are stories that we've heard that a number of state election director websites or other resources, that they weren't very specific, were hacked, and we don't know what was done and what the goals of those hacks were. But in the face of that, it raises the question that perhaps there was some attempt to attack the voting systems themselves. And in light of that, the purpose of these recounts, the reason why the recounts are going on, is to try to get to the bottom of it. Well, we have very reasonable allegations that a foreign nation state was trying to interfere with our elections. And in the case of Wisconsin and Michigan, we have hand-marked paper ballots that were tabulated largely by computers. So it's a very useful and relevant question to ask whether the electronic tabulation of the paper ballots was accurate. And by doing a recount, we can hopefully get some ground truth.
And when you say the electronic tabulation, is that done over the internet and therefore is vulnerable to hacking?
The tabulation is typically not done in any way involving the internet. The voting tabulation systems are generally kept in election official, election administration offices and are hopefully not connected to the internet at all. But the absence of an internet connection is not really a huge impediment to a nation-state attacker. Oftentimes, you might connect it to the internet for one thing or for another thing, to download a software update and then disconnect it again. Well, nation-state attackers know how to be patient and wait for those kinds of opportunities when they present themselves. And by virtue of there being paper ballots, we have the ability to do a recount where we can get an answer that will hopefully not depend on whether the tabulation computers were tampered or not.
But there is the potential. What you're telling us is there is the potential for example, a foreign actor like Russian intelligence to get into the tabulation in Wisconsin. We know, for example, that 2/3 of the voting machines are electronic in Pennsylvania, and they are, I think, very, very easily penetrated by hacking. But there are ways to get into these machines, not necessarily when the tabulation is being done, but prior to that? Or is that what you're telling us?
Okay, so let's separate paper ballot voting from electronic voting where the voter interacts with a touchscreen. They're really quite separate. When a voter is voting on a paper ballot, that ballot is typically scanned by a computer of some kind. And we have the risk that that computer could have been tampered with at some stage of the game, perhaps months in advance, perhaps not. That's a very real risk, and recounts help mitigate that risk. When we're talking about electronic voting machines, which are widely used in Pennsylvania and many other states, it's a very different set of challenges because there's no paper ballot that's left behind when the voter is done. So if there was somehow tampering with the touchscreen voting machines, then that tampering could silently change the record of the voter's intent, and we might have no way of recovering it. So we may or may not be able to discover evidence of that tampering. Whereas once we have a paper ballot, that does provide evidence that we could use to discover discrepancies.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Wallach, who's a professor in the Systems Group at Rice University's Department of Computer Science, where he manages Rice's Computer Security Lab. His research interests include mobile code, wireless and smartphone security, and the security of electronic voting systems. Well, initially, I believe in the letter from Alex Holderman at the University of Michigan that alerted the possibility that that there was a need for a recount, in particular in Wisconsin. I believe what the anomalies that he identified were in some of the rural counties, there was like a 7% deficit that seemed unexplained in the Hillary Clinton average voting.
So I'm not as familiar with the county-by-county specifics. My understanding is that several counties reported incorrect results and have since amended them. The details on the statistics are still coming out because the election statisticians, people who look at these kinds of things for a living, are still getting their hands on the raw data they need to do the work that they do.
Well, I think what you're saying here, Dan Wallach, is that there are anomalies, that there's good reason to be doing this, right? I mean, it's been controversial. A lot of pressure was put on the Clinton people to to step up and do something before the deadline, which passed last Friday. And then the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, stepped in and apparently found $6 million, which seems like an awful lot of money, and is able to do this. So there sounds like there's good reason to do this.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we have demonstrated anomalies. Mm-hmm. What we do have is a demonstrated foreign nation state who has both the talent and the motive to tamper with our elections. And that alone is enough basis to warrant doing a recount, because we want to make sure at the end of the day that the correct person won.
And would that extend then to Michigan and Pennsylvania?
Well, I mean, we don't know exactly which states may have been probed by Russia or other foreign nation states. We don't know what successes or failures they might have had. We have gotten very little information from the Obama administration or other parties to really tell us, the public, what actually is going on.
Do you think they know? Do you think Homeland Security, because they were forewarned, they apparently, the Homeland Security people, when they made the announcement along with the Director of National Intelligence some time back, some months ago, saying that it was the collective view of the American intelligence community that Russia has been involved in interfering in our elections, hacking the DNC, probing registration rolls in Illinois, for example. The Homeland Security put everybody on notice, and I understand they deployed resources to look at this kind of thing. So is there something the government's not telling us?
I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, the Obama administration sort of more or less suggested that they didn't have a problem with the results. So... But as you know, the Trump campaign has been extremely hostile towards the notion of a recount and particularly critical of Jill Stein.
Well, you know, I try not to get lost in the politics. Mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in this high-level idea that a foreign nation state might be trying to tamper with our elections. And in that environment, we need to make sure that our election equipment is operating correctly. We need to make sure that our totals are accurate. And we need to make sure that the only people who decide the next president of the United States are the voters of the United States, not anybody else.
So, therefore, with doubts about the election count in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, then it's reasonable then to proceed to erase those doubts, particularly where you can have evidence that's irrefutable, and that is paper ballots, and that exists in both Michigan and in Wisconsin. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. A way to understand it is that a recount is a process where you apply close scrutiny and time and expense, and in return you get a more accurate answer than you would have originally gotten. You know, for example, when a computer is scanning a ballot, it looks to see whether there's ink inside the bubble. But many voters will mark ballots in strange ways. Sometimes a voter will fill in one bubble and then X, put a big X through it and draw an arrow to another bubble. That sort of thing the computer doesn't see. But a human observer will say, oh, right, that voter clearly intended to not vote for this, but instead to vote for that. The standard, the so-called intent of the voter standard, is something that really takes a human observer to interpret. These kinds of things are slow and methodical and normally don't happen because most voters know how to operate filling in bubbles with pens. But when you get a close race or when you have a recount, then you pay attention and you spend the time, you spend the effort, you spend the money, and you get a more accurate count. And not only is it more accurate in terms of correct interpretation of voter intent, it's also more accurate in terms of errors in computers can't creep in and tamper with the outcome of the election.
Well, you've convinced me, Dan Wallach, that having this recount in Wisconsin is a good thing and a necessary thing, and we have nothing to lose.
Right. This is a pragmatic step that can help us better understand what happened during the election. And if things went wrong, this step, the work that we're doing in this recount will help us make sure that whatever problems don't happen again in the future.
Well, Dan Wallach, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Happy to be here with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Wallach, who's a professor in the Systems Group at Rice University Department of Computer Science, where he manages Rice's Computer Security Lab. His research interests include mobile code, wireless and smartphone security, and the security of electronic voting systems. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether Donald Trump will take credit for the fact that Barack Obama has brought the Islamic State to its knees. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq. He was a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and previously served as the Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and was the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups. And he has an article at Loeb Log, "Obama Brought the Islamic State to Its Knees, Watch Donald Trump Take the Credit." Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
Thanks, Ian.
And Wayne, you start your article out by making analogies to what happened with the fall of Nazi Germany in 1945, where the SS fanatics would go around and kill anybody in either the Wehrmacht or any civilian that they thought were cowards or traitors in this kind of frenzy of execution and fanaticism. And apparently that's what's going on inside Mosul now. The Iraqi army say they've killed at least 1,000, and there's supposed to be about 5,000 of these fighters there. But they're sort of killing not only civilians, but they're killing their own people who may well be disillusioned.
Yeah, it seems like in certain parallel situations, we can see equally extremist, noxious fanatics blaming their military defeats, which they don't realistically face up to otherwise, on failures of loyalty, failures of fanaticism. As early as even a couple months before the fall of Berlin, when the Soviets were on the on a front very close to Berlin, people who were just caught in rear areas without a pass, even though they were doing something, were just strung up immediately and hung by the SS. And the Islamic State seems to be in a parallel situation. Obviously, Allah is with them. This is the Islamic State, and al-Baghdadi is the caliph, so the only reason anything could be going wrong is that it's traitors and cowards. And they've also been killing people at the capital of Raqqa in Syria. They even set up a special police to round up deserters and foreign fighters trying to get back out of the failed Islamic State and go home, not as secret sleeper agents, but just to leave, you know, to save their lives.
Well, it is pretty clear, isn't it, that they're being rolled up, aren't they? I mean, not just in Mosul. And it probably, as you point out in your article at Loeb Log, Wayne White, "Obama Brought the Islamic State to Its Knees, Watch Donald Trump Take the Credit." The Iraqi army and the special forces would be doing it much quicker, one, had we not destroyed the Iraqi army in that ill-fated, ill-conceived invasion of Iraq. But two, you know, they're casualty-averse and they're taking their time. But the Kurdish fighters are doing very well in Raqqa against the Islamic State. So what would your prediction be of when, basically, they'll be finished as a fighting force?
finished absolutely, that's a tough one. But it won't be too far, I would say, into 2017. In other words, I have a, my inclination is that by the time Donald Trump, Peres the thought, takes the oath of office on January 20th, Mosul will have fallen, and probably Raqqa will have fallen also. And there's only one other significant city in their possession, for example, in Syria, Deir ez-Zor, but it's a really small desert city. All the major areas have fallen, and another thing that's going to happen to them is the more they lose large urban areas, the more they're exposed to airstrikes. They're in the open, or in small towns where they can't hide as easily. And so after the large towns are gone, it's going to be much harder for them to find cover, find a way to survive. Right now, the only reason they are still alive, frankly, is because the Syrians and the Russians, the bloody-minded Syrians, Russians, Iranians on that front, have spent almost all their time, 90 to 95% of their time, hammering away at the non-ISIS resistance in Syria, the rebels, and many of them supported by the West, because those are the ones that are in positions geographically in western, extreme western Syria that threaten or impede the regime's ability to build a coherent area. So they've left it alone, except for one dramatic drive, which to an ancient city, which proved their ability to move rapidly against it. And then Turkey's interference with the Syrian Kurds, who it has basically declared enemies, and there's been exchange of terrorism and whatnot and bombings, and have cut off largely the supplies from the Syrian Kurds. Syrian Kurds would have already taken Raqqa, would have taken Raqqa probably 2 or 3 months ago if it hadn't been for Turkey interfering.
Well, this is a complicated picture in general, and we have a very schizophrenic policy, nevertheless, because on the one hand, we're the air force, in effect, for the Iraqi Shiites. At the same time, we're opposing the Syrian Shiites and the Assad regime in league with the Russians. So is there any way to have some clarity in terms of the U.S. position?
I don't think so at this point, and I'll just say why. Once Russia intervened and took over airspace, significant airspace in the West, which is where the regime is doing all these cleaning operations against rebels that mostly we have no problem with, it's impossible to have any influence over what's happening, for example, in Aleppo, without confronting the Russians. In other words, sending our air cover over Aleppo would bring us into direct air-to-air combat, you know, with Russian aircraft. And so that is something that no one wants, you know, to see happen, you know, direct an actual, you know, confrontation between the two superpowers. So once Russia intervened, it sort of took any influence we could really have over the western part of Syria away. And the broken promises, the ruptured ceasefires, which frankly I don't think the Russians and the Syrians had the least intention of upholding, even though they were just temporary, that Secretary Curry tried to negotiate, just shows that there's no give over there. It's basically the Russians have an area of control that controls about one-fifth of Syria, and unfortunately the richest and well-watered one-fifth of Syria, and we can range about in the rest of it until they start pushing east against the Islamic State, probably wanting at some point in this, particularly after the fall of Raqqa, to want to at least control territory out in that direction as part of sovereignty.
And again, I'm speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq. He was a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and previously served as the Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and was the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups. And he has an article at Loeb Log, "Obama Brought the Islamic State to Its Knees, Watch Donald Trump take the credit. So you mentioned that already, but for Erdogan in Turkey having his obsession about the Kurds and reigniting a war with the Kurdish militants in Iraqi Kurdistan. Then he blames, of course, the Kurds, who are the only boots on the ground that have actually worked with the U.S. alliance against the Islamic State. You were saying that they would have taken Raqqa already, but for Erdogan's interference. He of course, is claiming to be against the Islamic State, but there's some evidence that he may actually have been helping them. He certainly helped with their underground railroad to get their fighters through Turkey into Syria. So is there any way to make sense of what Erdogan's... And, of course, now Erdogan is threatening the Europeans who don't want to accept him into the European Union because of his crackdown on the press and on the political opposition. He's now threatening to unleash more refugees on Europe. And my sense is that given what's happening now with Aleppo, with the Russians and the Iranians moving in with Assad's, what's left of Assad's army, won't there be a massive Sunni exodus from Syria if the Russians win in Aleppo, which they seem to be poised to do?
If Erdogan lets them out. It could very well be that Erdogan establishes at some point a cordon sanitaire all the way across the north, basically blocking the flight of further exiles. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that. Erdogan's going rogue. Some of us actually think that maybe the coup attempt, while it really did happen, was provoked by him, with the full knowledge that immediately afterward he would start slashing away at whole sectors of the society, from education to the press to the army, et cetera, in order to establish his own authoritarian state. And it just continues to proceed. He's not doing investigations on anyone to find out whether they're a Gulenist or whatever. It's slash and burn. Within 48 hours of that coup, he already had fired every single president of a university and a university college in the country. He had already fired 25 or I think it was 30,000 teachers. I mean, this man is really gone, as far as I'm concerned, as any manner of a reliable NATO partner, and he will deal in threats. My fear with respect to both Putin and Erdogan, where Trump at least fantasizes that he has some kind of a relationship with Putin and has business interests in Turkey that could very well affect his judgment, will basically be softer on these two at a time when that is the least the promising policy.
Well, but do you think, though, that Erdogan, there's two scenarios here. We saw what happened when Europe was swamped by refugees, and the former head of NATO, General Breedlove, accused Putin of weaponizing refugees. And my sense is that he can weaponize them even more, because there'll be greater numbers if once the Alawites, the murderous Assad regime, declare victory. I wouldn't want to be a Sunni anywhere near those people.
No, they can't flee to Iraq, Sunni Iraq, because the Shia will have closed in against the largely Sunni Islamic State and its friends. And so that's a back door is closed.
Sure. So where do they go?
Jordan is swamped.
Right.
It won't take anymore. You're right.
The one thing that I understand that what Erdogan wants is he wants to resettle the Sunni Arabs along the border and drive the Kurds out. So is that a possible scenario? There are two really bad scenarios. One is that Europe gets swamped again by refugees, and two, Erdogan uses the refugee situation as a way to resettle Sunnis along the border where the Kurds are, and then he goes to war against the Kurds.
Well, it's certainly something to think about. One problem there would be that I doubt that the Russians and the Syria and the ruling Alawite regime in in Damascus would want them back. I don't think it really cares whether they come back or not. In fact, it would probably be better for Assad if they left, because it increases what has been for a long time a lopsided advantage in population for Sunni Arabs, vice the small minority of Alawites and fragments of Shia who are loyal to him, and the Christian community, 10% of Syria that's Christian. He would like to shift that. Right now, it's almost 60% Sunni Arab. And so if they want to leave, I can't imagine an Assad not wanting him to leave. So I think that might bring, that could very well bring Syria and Turkey into conflict. Another issue that has been very sensitive for a long time is Syria's anger over Turkey, the powerful northern neighbors, in attempts to influence events in northern Syria, even, you know, raids against the Kurds crossing the border, even though the regime doesn't like the Kurds either. It doesn't want the Turks, you know, even making raids to attack the Kurds. And so it's a dicey situation there, and particularly with the Russians backing up the regime in Damascus. Now, the Russians have improved their relations with Erdogan. Of course, Erdogan is turning more to the Russians and having a summit meeting with Putin, because his relations with NATO are, you know, somewhat imploded. And so maybe the Russians will try to be peacemaker between Assad and Erdogan. That certainly won't serve our purposes either. I suspect the outcome of that wouldn't be very good.
So given that Obama doesn't have much longer in office, and that he's managed, you know, he said he would degrade and destroy the Islamic State, as you know from the election, Wayne White, Donald Trump made a big issue out of the Islamic State and how we're not doing it right and how he'd do it better. But by the time he gets into office, the job will be largely be done. And as you say, he'll probably take credit for it. He's already saying he would have won the popular vote, but for a voting fraud that doesn't exist. So this guy's capable of inventing anything to make himself look good.
He goes on incredibly aggressive offense whenever he is challenged or whenever anyone says something against him. And this is the trade craft he learned from the loathsome Roy Cohn, you know, of the McCarthy era, who was his lawyer and advisor when he was sort of cutting his teeth in New York in 1970s and early 80s. And so, oh, yes. And this is something we have to worry about in foreign policy. If somebody like some overseas leader insults Trump, or an overseas official, a senior official insults Trump, well, where does the relationship go if that happens to be one of our, you know, allies, and it isn't Duarte, and it isn't Erdogan, or it isn't Putin? Do we see him go on a Twitter war against one of our allies just because one allied cabinet member says the truth, which is he's very nervous about Trump? The man is dangerous.
Well, what's even worse, though, Wayne White, is that the person who's going to be his national security advisor, Secretary of State Colin Powell, referred to him as a nut job. And he, General Flynn, has hired, or has as his deputy, a person who's a Fox News ideologue. So there's no adult supervision.
And a highly outspoken anti-Iranian figure, you know, who's very close to the Israelis.
Right, but I'm saying that there's no professionalism there. There's no sobriety. There's no maturity that you'd need with a completely inexperienced and unstable president.
I think the worst thing, the worst aspect of this campaign victory of his is that he did it being Donald Trump. Had he had to clean up his act in the last few months of the campaign because he was not doing well being Donald Trump, I think he would have been in office with a more cautious approach. But he won being Donald Trump for a lot of reasons that weren't connected so much him winning as Hillary losing and Democrats not getting to the point. and straying over to third-party candidates and letting their spat with Hillary take precedence over a huge threat, you know, the 500-pound gorilla, you know, in the room, and allowing him to win, even though we lost the popular vote by a huge margin. So he doesn't have any inclination, I think, moderate much, because he really thinks that being himself works.
So he's been on the phone to Putin. What kind of deal? I mean, my understanding is we don't know how much Putin has over him, what kind of blackmail there might be there. We know that many of the oligarchs and the Siloviki around Putin have business dealings with Trump. We don't know the extent of that. And, you know, I think basically we'll get along with Russia largely because Trump will, you know, owes him something. There has to be a reason why, one, they interfered in our elections and what that was all about, and two, there has to be a reason why Trump has never been critical of Putin.
Yes, and the other danger I think we do have, and talking about deals out there, is that the people who elected Trump clearly are afraid of terrorism and clearly really don't care much about humanitarian issues overseas. Many of them would rather we just dumped all of our overseas aid. And so you could see Trump falling into a Putin-esque pattern or Israeli-esque pattern of just simply regarding as everyone who was opposing them out there as terrorists, not worthy of any real, you know, assistance or sympathy, and cutting deals that would not allow or even press for better deals for the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, for the Sunni Arabs in Syria, but simply sort of dismissing them in a manner that would be almost similar to an Erdogan, a Maliki, the former ill-fated prime minister in Iraq, or Assad.
Well, just in closing, Wayne White, Does that mean that as bad as the Middle East is, that it could actually get worse, that Donald Trump will make an even greater mess of it than it already is?
Could be. Could very well be. And the Middle East is just one concern. The situation in Asia and between the superpowers, and I'm very worried, having attended so many meetings and know how important it is, NATO, our NATO allies, that could overshadow at many times the Middle East, you know, my own area of expertise. I think he just is so sold on himself and his own brash behavior, trying to, you know, not go too heavy on it, but it's far more than brash, that his views could be fed and funneled into a foreign policy that is not a very desirable one, a very disruptive one, and in fact, in that light, one wonders why a relative moderate like Mitt Romney even wants to be the facade of this regime facing outward to the world, having to carry out Trump-like orders.
Well, that's why I don't think he'll take the job. But Trump's talking to Petraeus today, and General Petraeus, of course, was already approached by K.T. McFarlane, the Deputy National Security Advisor now named by Trump to serve under General Flynn. And she offered Petraeus the job of running for president, financed by Rupert Murdoch. The campaign would be conducted by Roger Ailes, and all Petraeus had to do was to sign on the dotted line, and it was a done deal. And this, of course, was when Petraeus was in charge of Afghanistan, working under his commander-in-chief, Barack Obama, who K.T. McFarlane was trying to get him to run against him in 2012. I mean, we know from that tape, which I presume Petraeus made public, but there's a chance that he may pick Petraeus.
Yes, and what we've seen is an extremely appalling lack of morality, lack of honor, you know, among so many officials, like Nikki Haley, who knows exactly what Trump is, gleefully accepting the UN ambassador job, which is nothing but, you know, a lightweight job in the administration. Hell, I would have stayed as governor of South Carolina rather than accept that job. But you can see people like her, people like Mitt Romney, who roundly denounced him, only too happy, you know, to just throw aside all of their deeply held, I'm sure they were very serious, deeply held qualms about him, and just dive in. And, you know, in that context, the general is, you know, this is Metraeus, was a very sensible man. He was a good man, not including the, you know, cheating on his wife part. I'm talking about administering and having a more enlightened policy in Iraq. But now he's quite willing to dive in and play ball with Donald Trump. I don't know what this says about him.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group and previously served as the Deputy Director of the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia and the State Department's representative to the NATO Middle East Working Groups. And he has an article at Loeb Log. Obama brought the Islamic State to its knees. Watch Donald Trump take the credit. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with an expert on Cuba who's written extensively about Fidel Castro, who she has also interviewed. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anne-Louise Bardak, who is a Penn USA award-winning journalist and the author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She has an article at The Guardian, Glory and My Place in History, Do Not Worry Me, My Interview with Fidel Castro. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Louise Bardak.
My pleasure.
And Annie, the death of Fidel Castro, of course, at the age of 90, was not entirely a surprise. He'd been had a near-death experience back in 2006 when I think he had diverticulitis, toxemia as a result of it, and almost died. And that's when his brother took over. So what's your sense then of how much current leader, the younger brother, Raul, has been under his older brother's shadow and will emerge as a more assertive player in terms of the trajectory of reform?
Certainly more so than Fidel. I think one would be mistaken to think that Raul is, you know, a great liberal social democrat. He's not. He's going to do what he believes will be sufficient for his island to survive and for the Castro family to survive. Because, of course, this is a dynasty, and it has been since 1959, and a very successful, I would say the most successful political partnership, arguably in history, between Fidel and Raul, with Fidel being the strategist, politician to put this little island nation on the world map, previously known just for sugar, wet sex and sin, something like that, and make it a global player of sorts. And Raul Runt being the head of the Cuban Armed Forces, which has been and remains and will be for the foreseeable future the most important institution in Cuba, followed by the Communist Party.
Well, but they do have problems. They, you know, when Russia abandoned them, they had to improvise, and then Hugo Chavez came to the rescue with free oil, and now Venezuela, its economy is in free fall, and that may dry up. So what's your sense of this wild card that is now the President of the United States, Donald Trump? basically being the bull in the china shop in terms of what Raul Castro and Barack Obama were able to put through under the auspices of Pope Francis.
Well, one needs to know that Obama's initiatives are done under executive orders. Technically, executive orders can be undone by the next chief executive or president. Now, Donald Trump, true to form and fashion, has been doing a lot of trumpeting, tweeting, texting, etc. And he has made some promises in South Florida to older, hardcore Cuban exiles and said he's going to end this day one, he's going to rescind all that, etc. I would imagine that Donald Trump will end up meddling, refashioning to a certain extent these executive orders. He's not going to terminate it. The first flight arrived in Cuba today, from a major airline arrived, interestingly enough, you know, heralding in the new moment. But I think there'll be a lot of Trumpian fireworks. I think where he will have his greatest influence was that there was tremendous movement to end the U.S. embargo, which must be done by both houses of Congress. That was changed in the 1990s when Jorge Mascanosa got nervous about future presidents ending it with a pen. Well, it was on its way to being changed, but you can imagine that that will no longer be the case with the new Republican Congress and the promises that Trump has made. Now, that all being said, in the 1990s, Trump was among the first to send emissaries down to Cuba seeking business opportunities or feeling it all out while he was also lambasting Fidel Castro as we can never do business there. So we know that there's the public Trump, there's the private Trump, and there's the entrepreneurial Trump, and there's the what's in it for me Trump. So we have a lot of Trumps to configure here. And the upshot, I believe, will be altering, nibbling at the ends of it, of Obama's orders, but not terminating it, certainly not, because of the amount of business interests involved, Chamber of Commerce from many, many countries, but certainly the vote on ending the U.S. embargo is he will be a much tougher negotiator than Barack Obama.
And again, I'm speaking with Ana Luisa Bardach, who's a Penn USA award-winning journalist and author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She has an article at The Guardian, Glory and My Place in History, Do Not Worry Me, My Interview with Fidel Castro. Let's talk about your interview with Fidel Castro that took place in January of 1994. You did the interview for Vanity Fair magazine, and it was at a time when Bill Clinton was having his problems, Lewinsky problems, and I take it that in your sort of warm-up chat with Fidel Castro, he was completely mystified by all of this sort of moralistic stuff going on in the United States vis-a-vis Bill Clinton, since, of course, Fidel Castro has fathered a dozen children with several different women.
Yes, that's true. I must say, you know, when you do an interview with Fidel, he's very controlled, very prepared. You know, he's a master of public relations, or as he calls it very brazenly, he calls it propaganda, as he famously wrote in a letter saying to a colleague and when he was in prison to one of his comrades, he wrote, "Never, never forget propaganda. It is the soul of our struggle, our revolution." So he was pretty much on point most of the time. But I must say that when the subject of the new president having issues with some dalliances came up, he truly looked at me baffled, like, "Can you illuminate me about this?" And at one point, he just didn't seem to comprehend this. And at one point he said, well, you know, in a lot of countries, I'm paraphrasing, having a lot of girlfriends is regarded as a very positive thing. And I remember when I was there in 98 for the big, big, big event of John Paul the Pope coming to Cuba, and we're all there, and the whole news corps is there, and suddenly it is announced that some, you know, Monica Lewinsky's skirt is found or something, and all the big anchors just fled. And I remember the head of, what would you could say, the handler for all the foreign media who, you know, a member of the ruling elites, saying to me, this is a conspiracy. The CIA has created this conspiracy to take attention away from Cuba. And I said, no, I know it looks like that, but in the United States, you know, a liaison Trump's history with popes and rulers. So they didn't believe it. They thought it was planned. They thought it was a setup to get Cuba. That's how remote that sensibility is from Castro's. You know, when I did ask him once in the famous Vanity Fair interview, which, by the way, I have just found out is being posted on Vanity Fair as it appeared, Conversations with Fidel Castro. It is on my website, but and I think The Guardian posted it, but Vanity Fair in the day didn't. You know, we wanted people to buy magazines, not read things online, but they are putting it online on the Vanity Fair Hive website if people want to read what was a fairly historic interview of great length during the special period.
So what do you think Fidel Castro meant when he made a slight sort of apology, if you will, and said that he was guilty of excessive paternalism? For a dictator running the family farm like the Assad family has been running Syria, you know,
yeah.
It's...
Yeah, it's, you got it. Yeah, excessive paternalism. In other words, we know what's better for you. And a lot of people interpret it as that, well, you know, having my home in Havana and our little home in the countryside, we thought was better for us to have, not to be confiscated. Having our clothing store in downtown Havana, we thought that was also rather a good idea, rather than to have it confiscated and now no one can find clothes. So that's what his euphemism for being a little paternalistic meant. It is the great tragedy of Cuba that its best and brightest have just left in waves, beginning at the very beginning. Of course, you had people who were loyal to Batista, but after that, you just, and it continues today, and it's very sad, and it's enough of a problem that we have none other than Raul Castro has brought it up several times. He calls it the youth drain, the brain drain. When Donald Trump talks about the Mexicans at the borders, he's incorrect. The people who are storming the borders and have been for the last 2 years are Cubans. They are coming from Miami, coming up through the Florida Straits, but they're mostly trying to do it more safely, and they go to Texas, and they are the ones crossing the border by the thousands. And the reason they're doing that is they're concerned that it's going to be the end of wet foot, dry foot, which gives them a special policy where they get fast-tracked into citizenship. And they're very concerned about that ending. And Trump has said that that's a bad policy. So he could. He may just end that. And people like Rubio and Ileana Ross in Florida also have turned their nose on that policy, because a lot of people turned out to be commuters back and forth, Havana. And in other words, they weren't fleeing so much repression, but how do we get economic opportunity and do business between the two countries? So that is really a problem, the flood of educated people who feel like, look, I'm a nuclear physicist or I'm a brain surgeon. I don't really want to be working for $30 an hour. I hear I could get a job in Orlando and work for at least, you know, $350 a week, even if I have to do my degree over.
Well,
and they'll go.
Well, you earlier, and Luis Bardach mentioned Jorge Mascanosa, the head of the right-wing Cuban mm-hmm. group, and is his son running it now? But
Masantos. But remember, yeah. Jorge Masantos, his son,
right.
became quite a moderate, and he was one of the voices pleading for rapprochement with Cuba. Because of that, he got sidelined by the hardliners.
Mm-hmm.
But Obama met with Masantos, and Masantos was invited to the White House. And so he's very different than what his father was. He got it. You know, Fidel won, and they lost. He got that.
Right. But
that's just, whatever you may feel, if you hate him or you love him, that was the upshot. When you can stay in power for over 55 years, you've won and the other side has lost. And history will very likely not absolve Fidel Castro as he promised it will, but history will stand back and appreciate his stamina, his strategy, his prescience, his ability to play on the global stage, and his ability to more or less outwit 11 American presidents.
Well, but that doesn't mean that the Marco Rubios of the world and the Ted Cruzes and the hardliners in Miami. I mean, essentially, we've had a zombie policy. You know, it's just the walking dead. Years and years of a failed embargo that's done nothing but keep the Castro brothers in power. And now, you know, you've got radio and TV Martí broadcasting every day to no one but costing the taxpayers a fortune and so forth. It's just these people, and Eliana Ross-Layton, another example of these professional Castro haters that are just literally like zombies. Reality doesn't seem to intrude. So do you think that they're going to get a breath of fresh air with Trump? As you pointed out, history's already passed them by, but they haven't noticed.
well, again, look how the vote came down on Cuban exiles, and you remember they were a very active voting force. You know, this is, you know, the rap on Latinos and Hispanics is, yeah, but many don't register, many don't vote. The Cuban Americans got that day one. They all register, they all vote. That's the big difference in why they've been able to exert the power that they have. They have been very organized in that respect. And the upshot has been that the older históricos, as we call them, the old guard, tended to vote for Trump, and everybody under 50 went for Hillary Clinton. It was roughly split down the middle. And that's a big improvement from when it was always a rock-solid GOP enclave. It no longer is. And coupled in with Florida, with all the Puerto Ricans and Nicaraguans, and remember, Puerto Ricans can vote and do vote, and all the newly arrived, I mean, Venezuelans are arriving literally by the boatload in any form they can get out of Venezuela today. You know, they no longer have the demographic heft of being the most dominant. The Central American, Latin American countries together will soon have a higher demographic in terms of numbers.
Well, but just in closing, Ana Luisa Bardach, the still 1 in 3 Latinos voted for Trump. That's across the country. Maybe most of them were from Cuba, but there still was a sense that more Latinos would have been outraged by what Trump said about them. And that's pretty amazing to think that that didn't play a bigger role and that didn't factor in any of the people down in Cuba. Don't they have any a sense of pride that this man was insulting a whole ethnicity?
That's a really big, complicated, thorny question. And it has to do with things that often don't get said, Ian, that many Cubans don't see themselves as Latinos in the sense that Mexican Central Americans, it's a very different culture. Caribbean life and culture and speech is very different because they don't have the Indian component, whereas Central America and Latin America, the Spanish weren't able to do what they did in Cuba, which is slaughter all the Indians. So you have an Afro-Cuban Spanish culture in Cuba. So there's always been a little bit of us and them. There's always been a somewhat of a superiority. You know, we're not Indians. They're descended from Spain, which makes us brilliant. We're Jews. The expression in Cuba has always been, somos los judíos del Caribe. We are the Jews of the Caribbean. And in their mind, that means we're the smart guys here. And so yes, many, many Cuban Americans are very offended. I would say the majority. But there is a cultural imprint of being different. To say Cuba and Mexico barely share a common language if you hear it spoken. And the culture is very different. And the attitudes are different. Although Mexico was very hospitable to Fidel Castro, and he loved that. But you may recall there was a time when Fidel Castro tape-recorded a Mexican prime minister, aired it on TV, and was happy to humiliate the Mexican foreign minister. It's a complicated relationship, but I think the younger generations are feeling much more sense of brethren with all Hispanics and all Latinos. But the old guard, they feel very much almost sui generis. You know, and Cuba is different. We were fleeing communism. We were fleeing totalitarianism. You guys just want to be able to go to a grade school, you know. So it's complex. But I think even people like Rubio, who was once on the immigration reform bill, then he was off the immigration reform bill, he talks a little bit down the middle now. So we are seeing that morphed somewhat. But, you know, the brotherhood of the Hispanic man, I wouldn't say that was really part and parcel of the Cuban mindset.
Well, Ana Luisa Bardek, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Ana Luisa Bardek, who's a Penn USA award-winning journalist and author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She has an article at The Guardian, Glory and My Place in History, Do Not Worry Me, My Interview with Fidel Castro, which again is available at the website for Vanity Fair. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Federico Garcia and Graham Fitzgibbon, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.